I guess I'd say that there's probably more possibility than you think for yourself or for the world more broadly, that things aren't going to stay the way they are. And that can be really scary, but that there's also a lot of opportunity inherent there as well. And so I just feel like, I don't know, there's no need to be modest about your ambitions or your hopes. You know, if there's something that you want to do or something that you want to see happen in the world, to just move toward it, you know, one little tiny step at a time. And you know, you can be a part of how things change.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Quaker Matters Podcast. On today's episode, we are joined by Zach Williams, Wilmington Friends School class of 2002. During our conversation, Zach talks about his Wilmington Friends School experience and how his WFS teachers inspired him to go into the teaching profession, what he enjoys most about being a writer, what it's like to get a story published in The New Yorker, and his first book that was recently published titled Beautiful Days. We hope you enjoy.
Hey, Zach, how are you?
Hey, good, Jake. How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Of course. Before we dive into your career, I want to spend a little time talking Wilmington Friends School and your experience here at Friends. So could you just first tell me when you were introduced to Wilmington Friends School as a student?
Yeah, it was pre-kindergarten. 1989 to 1990, I think, was the year. And my pre-K teacher was Shirley Rigby. One of the things I remember about her was that she had written a book, a picture book, called Smaller Than Most, which was about like a family of pandas. And I had a copy of the book. And I can remember feeling really inspired by that my teacher had written a book. And so, yeah, so she was the first writer I ever knew, I think. I still remember that. But yeah, 1989. Mm-hmm.
In what ways, knowing that that was 20 years ago, but in what ways might you still feel connected to Friends?
I mean, in a lot of different ways. I think certainly through people. You know, I think a lot of my closest friends in the world are still my WFS friends. You know, they're people that I've known since elementary school that I'm still like in really frequent contact with, people that are really important to me. And then, you know, through teachers, I've been in touch with a few of my old teachers over the last couple of years, especially like Bill Bickley and Terry McGuire in particular. But all of those teachers were so important to me in that I learned how to teach from them, and teaching has been a big important part of my life. So I think I feel very connected to the school and to my education there in that way. But then I would say too that I also feel a kind of like a sort of a deeper, maybe like a philosophical connection that comes just from the values of the school and of a Quaker education. I think like having Meeting for Worship as a part of my life from a very young age, the fact that a Quaker school makes space for quiet and for reflection and contemplation, I think that was enormously important to me and really crucial to the particular way that I developed, I think, and the kinds of things that I came to value. So I think that I came to understand the importance of patience and then listening, really, because of those experiences. So I feel very, very impacted by my years at Friends.
I don't want to get you in trouble here and ask you to pick a favorite teacher, but you mentioned Mr. Bickley in that last answer, and you mentioned Mr. McGuire as well. I guess I was wondering if you might be able to speak to various teachers or coaches that really impacted you, and then also sort of speak to their impact on you to this day.
Yeah, no, for sure. Okay, so I'll try to be quick, but I got to say a few different names, if that's okay.
That's great.
Because really, I mean, the teachers at Friends were just really, really incredible. And I really feel such gratitude for my experiences with them. I think that like really going back to like elementary school, I think about teachers like Lear Pfeiffer and Pat Davis. I think they were really instrumental for me in identifying a love of writing and of reading. John Huxtable was a really inspirational teacher. I think often about his sixth grade class. He taught us in that class these foundational academic skills, like how to take notes, how to do research, how to organize an argument. So that was huge, something that was really important to me. And then, you know, my English teachers, the Friends School had such an incredible, at the time I was there, I'm sure it still does, English program. And these people really, I feel like, taught me how to read and how to express myself in writing, you know, from middle school up, like Adrienne Burston, Terry Maguire, Matt Michikay, Katie Kenny, Bill Bickley, Kim Combs, Micheline McManus. And then I would add to that too, Richard Bernard and Rick Beer Reynolds. You know, it was just a really incredible program. So I know the question's about one, but I do feel like that there was this whole kind of program. There was this kind of cumulative effect of taking all of these classes over the years. And in me, it instilled a love of reading. But I think even more than that, it taught that reading and language and writing were important, and that it was a good and useful thing to do, to read books. I really felt like the value of art was never in question at Friends, like that art and creativity were central to the school's mission. And that really did a lot to shape my own sense of self and to give me, I don't know, like confidence, I guess, and a sense of permission to value creativity, that was a good thing to do. To want to write stories was a good use of your time. You know what I mean? I would also say too, that like free reading was a really core part of the English curriculum from sixth grade through 12th. We were always encouraged to read and to read good books. And so that was really, I learned so much through that, being able to pick my own books to read. But then I would be remiss if I did not mention Bob Tattersall as well, Coach T. I was on Bob Tattersall's football team, ninth grade through 12th grade. I was not an athlete, not even remotely close to an athlete. But that team, the way that it was run, you know, Coach T always referred to it as the program. He would call it the football program. And that's really what it was. It was a program that took kids in ninth grade, worked with them through 12th. And it was an educational program, I think, almost more than anything else. You know, and that's when I think about my friend school experience, like that's where on the football team, that's where I was pushed really far beyond the boundaries of what I felt capable of. Like I had to do things that I really didn't think it was possible for me to do on that team. And, you know, I learned that I could like survive that and that those experiences could make me stronger. And I'm extraordinarily grateful for those years on the football team.
That's really cool. I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah.
So transitioning post Wilmington Friends, you go to Hopkins, you graduate from Hopkins, and you enter the world of teaching. So my first question in terms of your teaching career, like when was this something that you knew you wanted to explore and pursue?
I always liked English class and I always liked my English teachers. And I think like as far back as high school, I thought like, well, I could do that. I could see myself being an English teacher. I remember thinking like, you know, yeah, I really might do that, except for like, I know that I probably won't or can't, because I just really hate like early mornings so much. Like I hate having to get up so early in the morning. So I guess I won't ever pursue it. But then I did. I taught middle and high school for 12 years and I hated the early mornings like the whole entire time, like throughout the whole entire 12 years, I hated it. So I guess I learned that was just on a part of life, I guess. Part of having a job. But no, I think that from pretty early on, I thought I felt like my teachers were role models in that way. Yeah.
What did you enjoy most about teaching English at both middle and upper school levels? Obviously, the early mornings were a big con, but some pros. What are some of those? Or what were some of those?
I loved seeing students grow. Like, so I think about my job at the Browning School in New York City in particular, and there were kids that I taught as sixth graders in that job. I taught a lot of different levels in that job. So I taught kids as sixth graders, and then I taught them again as eighth graders, and then again as 10th graders, you know. And the kids that I taught in eighth grade my first year there were graduating seniors my last year there. And so that was like a really just fascinating thing to be able to work with students and see them grow and see them, you know, yeah, see them become young adults. And now, you know, I have students now from the beginning of my teaching career who are, I don't know, in their early 30s. And it's like, that's really an amazing thing to me, just to kind of, I don't know, see how people are doing. But I would say too, like the texts, like the books that I taught, there were some things like reading the same books year after year is just something that you would like never do otherwise, I think, unless you were teaching them. And I really learned so much that way. Like I think about, I taught Romeo and Juliet, for example, like every year for 10 years, 10 consecutive years. And like by the end of it, I really felt like I knew that play inside and out. And, you know, that was a really wonderful experience that I wouldn't have had if I wasn't teaching eighth grade English.
So during your years as an English teacher, you also got back into writing fiction. And so obviously, like, you had a love of English dating back to, even to your point, like, just understanding that you had a pre-K teacher that, like, wrote a book, which was cool and a core memory that still sticks with you. I guess, how does one go about getting back into writing fiction on top of your full-time job and responsibilities? How did that start for you?
Yeah, well, you know, so there was so much that I loved about my teaching jobs, but I did, like, when I started them, when I was like 22 or something like that, maybe 23, what I really wanted to do was be a writer or work in some creative capacity. And I felt like I wanted to be a teacher too. And I wanted to try that and to learn how to do it. And I thought that I would enjoy it and that I'd be good at it and that I'd grow from it, I guess. But, I always felt like this will be for a few years and then I'm going to kind of get my writing thing figured out or figure out whatever I'm going to do next. That was always kind of in the back of my mind. And then, but I did it for 12 years. So it was felt like a lot more than a few. And, like in the course of that time, I got married and, my wife Rosalie and I had, our first son and, our first child. That is to say, we have one boy and one girl, Ray and Audrey. And, it was like, as these kind of years built up, it just sort of, eventually it just kind of got to a point where I felt like, okay, you know, I really let a lot of years go by and I haven't been doing this. I always liked writing, as you said, but I did a lot of it in undergraduate too. Like, I was a creative writing major in undergraduate. So I just felt like there was something that I was sort of supposed to be doing that I'd kind of left sitting on the table, just something that I just had never really gone for it in this way that I started to feel disappointed by enough that I just started working when I had a little bit of free time here and there. And so I would write in the summers, and then on, you know, winter break and spring break. And I started to get kind of better at it. And I think that I felt that at that time, I sort of finally had things that felt really interesting to me to write about. I think part of what had happened was that in my 20s, I just didn't really know like what to write about, you know, like I didn't really have a lot of material, I don't think, but I think that like having kids, like suddenly I felt like I had material. I found myself writing a lot of stories about parenthood. And so once I put a certain amount of work into it, then it kind of developed a kind of logic of its own. It's like a snowball effect. You get kind of like halfway into a bunch of stories and you got to finish them is how it feels. And so you got to kind of put more and more time into it. And, eventually it got to a point where I just felt like the summer would end and I'd have to stop writing. And I started to kind of dread it, you know, the end of the summertime when I could do that work. And so, so I applied to grad school so I could try to carve out a chunk of time to focus on it.
So was that, because my next sort of question was going to lead into, like, after 12 years of teaching, making the leap to, hey, I'm actually going to leave this to go to NYU, where you were also still teaching undergrad students, but was that a big leap? Or I guess in listening to your previous answer, that almost felt like what you needed to have happen because those summers didn't feel quite long enough. So obviously attending grad school and being able to write and really be there and in the arena, that probably felt needed for you.
It was both things. It felt really necessary and I was so thrilled to have the opportunity to do it. And it also was a huge leap and it was really scary. And I had a lot of, I remember sitting in my boss's office, John Boddy, the head of school at the Browning School, who was a great friend. As I talked through him with this, I told him, like, you know, I have this opportunity to do this. I'm thinking about it. I'm trying to figure it out. And he helped me talk through it. And it was the thing to talk through. It was like, you know, leaving a job, leaving a career and doing something different. It was really scary. It was the way that I kind of justified it to myself was that, as you said, I would have the opportunity to teach undergraduates at New York University. So I thought, like, okay, well, maybe that's something that I can, that's something that I then have on my resume, and maybe I'll teach college someday. And, you know, maybe this is kind of a step toward doing that. So that's kind of how I couched it, I guess. But it is true that what I really was excited about was just the time to get this writing project done. I thought that I could make some real headway that I just wouldn't be able to if I didn't have that.
What did you learn most about yourself as you navigated the NYU experience of both being a student and studying, but also teaching undergrad students?
The first thing that I learned was that I was like, I had way more work to do than I had previously understood. Like the whole thing about like, oh, I just need some time to finish that project. Like everything I just said, I was basically wrong about that. It wasn't just that I needed time to finish the project. It was that I needed the education that the MFA program had to offer. It was like, I realized that in all of my time, I felt, teaching English for so long, I had like a good sense of how to read from an English point of view, like from an analytic point of view, but there was a kind of a whole other way of reading that I learned at NYU that had to do with reading the way that a writer might, like thinking about how stories are built, thinking about like narrative structure as somebody who wants to write stories. You know, it's just a different way than thinking about themes and things like that. So I had an incredible amount to learn, I realized, and I had these wonderful teachers who taught me way more about writing than, you know, I would have thought possible. So it was an amazing experience in that way. And then as far as the teaching was great. It was like, it was teaching undergraduate creative writing workshops. I think it's like a great joy as a teacher because it's something that students are very interested in. It's a little bit less rigorous in certain ways than teaching an English class because it's like, it's centered on student work. It's centered on student creative expression and just trying to like help people in this room full of students sharpen their work and do better work, and everybody's supportive of one another, you know, as students talk about one another's work. And it's the class, the structure of a creative writing class, workshop class, I think is set up in such a way as to produce a positive experience for people. It's like the people take the class because they want to be enriched by it. And so it just makes the job really easy, I think, and really, really rewarding. I remember all the stories and the poems that my kids at NYU wrote in 2019. You know, it's like it stays with you. You have a real connection to your students that way because they're sharing their, you know, their vulnerable creative work with you, their rough drafts and things like that.
How surprised were you when you were one of five fiction writers selected for the Stegner Fellowship at Stanford?
Like 10 out of 10. Like, I mean, it was not on my radar. I had sort of forgotten that I had applied because it just never in a million years would I have thought, yeah, that this thing might happen. And I wasn't, you know, I was getting ready to graduate from NYU and I wasn't totally sure what was going to happen. And NYU has a kind of third year fellowship that they offer to one person per year. And I was like hoping that there might be a chance that I would get that, but I had no sense that this application that I had sent off to Stanford in the fall it was a total shock to me. We were living in New York and we moved with our son and our very, very newborn daughter, Audrey, to San Francisco. So it was a really big, really crazy year. And it felt that way. It felt crazy as it was happening.
How were you able to navigate this exciting yet also extremely challenging transition?
I feel like we survived it because we were lucky to have like a lot of just support from our family. It was like everybody, my parents and then my wife Rosalie's parents, it was like everybody was sort of unanimous that like we had to do this. It was there was no, I feel really extraordinarily lucky in that way. There was nobody that was saying like, hey, I think this is a really bad idea. I really don't think you should do this. Everybody was like, this sounds like an amazing opportunity. So people kind of rallied behind us. I mean, in various ways, we had to, you know, store things at my parents' house. You know, we were moving out of our place in Brooklyn and all kinds of stuff like that. And even since then, people have been, you know, now we're far away, people come to visit us. And I'm sort of consistently just really moved and humbled by all the sort of love and support we've had. So I feel really lucky about that.
How did the cohort of writers who were selected for the Stegner Fellowship, how did they help you grow your own writing?
The Stegner program and the cohort and all that, it was absolutely incredible. It was 2 years, a 2-year fellowship in which really the only thing that you have to do is write. So I was writing full time and then just be a part of this group, this 10-person group of writers. So there's 5 new writers each year and it's a 2-year thing. So 10 at any given time. And you meet with them once a week in a workshop format. And they're all really, really, really good writers, and people are, like astoundingly good writers. And people were, it was the first time that I had ever been around, like close to the first time I'd ever really been around people who were like publishing. Like, so people had books coming out and, stories coming out in places. I think it had an impact on what I felt like might be possible, you know, just to like kind of see people going through these processes. And then to read everybody's writing in workshop was just really great and pushed me in my own sense of what was possible. But then too, like there were times when, we would read a story in workshop, and then a few months later, that story would be in the New Yorker. So I just had a sense of being around all these amazing people and being really, really lucky for that. The instruction in the workshop too, you know, we had our workshop instructors were the writers Adam Johnson and Elizabeth Talent and Chang Ray Lee. And they're all just absolutely brilliant and, you know, took really good care of us. And so I felt extraordinarily nurtured by it. Like it's just a real incredible lightning bolt of good luck that I'm sort of grateful for every day.
Okay, so can you just take me to the moment, I guess, when you found out that one of your stories was going to be in the New Yorker? Like, what is that, like a phone call? I have zero idea how this process works. That just feels like very much a pinch me moment, and something to your previous point, being in those rooms with these outstandingly good writers, you start to think about the possibilities and what could become a reality. And that did for you, which is so cool.
Yeah, it did feel really crazy. And it was also, you know, it was kind of scary in a little way too. I had never had anything published in print before. And so it was like a big arena to enter into the first time without sort of like rehearsal for that is how I felt a little bit. So it was like, it was kind of everything all at once. It was really exciting, really stressful, kind of scary, you know, but the way that it happened, was that at the, you know, at the end of my time at NYU, the program at NYU facilitated, contact between students and literary agents, in New York City. And I got put in touch with an agent named Claudia Ballard, who's been my agent for the last few years. I sent her this story. This one is called Wood Swirl House. And she just sort of immediately had it pegged. She read it and, you know, we talked on the phone and she said, I want to send it to the New Yorker. And I thought, okay, you feel like great, you know, like wonderful. And so she did. And, you know, it took a little while for them. I can't remember how long it took, a couple months maybe, for them to get back with the acceptance. But then it was an email from Deborah Treisman at the New Yorker. And yeah, it was pretty surreal. I mean, it was definitely like a pinch me kind of thing. And then the funny thing too, and I feel this happens like a lot, like as a in the writing life, is like, it was really, really exciting. But then also too, like it didn't actually like change anything about that day. Or, you know, it was like the story got slotted for publication a few months after that. So it was like the whole process happened really slowly. And, you know, I still had to get up and do my work every day, you know? So it was like, it was really exciting. And then also too, there was a lot of kind of like hurry up and wait in it, you know? It was like, okay, this thing's going to happen a few months from now. So I did my best just to try not to think about it too much.
Who are some of your literary influences and how have they shaped your writing style and or like storytelling techniques?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think about books that I read at friend school. And some of these were free reading books. I remember reading The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury in middle school. And then that was a huge book for me. And I that's one of the few books as a kid that I would reread. I would read it over and over. And then I read in ninth grade, I read On the Road by Jack Kerouac, which I still vividly remember like seeing it on this list of the summer reading list, you know, that was put together by the English department. And that, you know, that book really changed my life. And I think kind of got me, or like laid the ground for me then later to read, like in college, to read Virginia Woolf and James Joyce and then people like that, like Thomas Pynchon and Cormac McCarthy and Joy Williams. I think that like I really like writers who are very sort of musical in their prose. And I think that, I don't know, I like writers who can write really, really rhythmic sentences, musical sentences. And I think that's probably what I take most from the writers that I really like, is the sort of sound of their writing, trying to incorporate something from it into mine.
Do you have any specific rituals, routines that help you get in the mindset of writing? Or is it like, hey, I'm just firing up the laptop, let's go?
No, it definitely does become like a ritual thing. It's a little bit of a weird lifestyle I've learned, because I didn't really understand this, I think, on the front end of it. Like, it's a little bit of a weird lifestyle because it's very solitary. I mean, when you have the opportunity really to just sit and work uninterrupted, I mean, I'm teaching this here, so I have less of that, but it's, you do spend a lot of time kind of on your own. Yes, yeah, certainly with the laptop, but, the biggest part of the ritual for me, I think, is blocking my internet so that I don't check my email every 3 seconds rather than, you know, try to focus on what I'm doing. And, I also listen to a lot of ambient music when I write. So it's like between those days, like no internet and this, you know, kind of gentle ambient music. And it kind of gets me into a certain kind of headspace. But earlier when I mentioned meeting for worship, I think that, I don't know if I would have turned out the same way if I hadn't been in meeting for worship once a week from pre-kindergarten on, you know, like, and having that kind of quiet time, in my life, because that's, you know, a lot of writing is about quiet time, I think. So yeah, that's the ritual of it for me.
When you have the quiet time and you're listening to the music, but then also blocking the internet, like, is it like, hey, I have this like 4 hour chunk, or like what's the, obviously knowing like you have a family and kids and so like yeah. what's and you're also teaching, so is this like, hey, I'm gonna try to find 2 hours today, 4 hours here, like how do you chunk that time?
It's been really hard this year, because I'm learning how to balance the teaching, with it for, you know, and I have a book coming out over the summer, and so there's been stuff to do regarding that. So I've got a lot of emails and things like that. So I haven't gotten as much of it done this year. I'm trying to just stay relaxed about that, because, you know, I have the big project I was working on is done. So I'm trying to just to, you know, not worry about it too much and figure it out next year when I have some more time, I think. But yeah, I think that, a lot of times, like, the time of it for me is like kind of tied to how long I'll block my internet for. So it's like I 4 hours is kind of the upper limit of how long I'll block my internet for. The kids come home usually about 4 o'clock, and I work in the sort of like this little room built out of the garage of our house. So I can hear their footsteps up ahead, and usually I want to go up and say hi to them. If I'm really, really in the zone, sometimes I'll try to hold off on doing that, but it's tough when you got little kids upstairs, for sure. You want to go hang out.
Both of your stories in The New Yorker have some type of alternate realities. A question here would be, what do you enjoy most about creating these pieces in supernatural elements?
I think it's like just such a natural part of how I think. I think it would be like harder for me not to write that way. So like I grew up, like in the 90s watching the X-Files and like reading books about UFOs and yeah, I mean, definitely every single book on UFOs at the Wilmington Friends School Library, you know, from 1989 to 2002, I checked it out and read it. It's just like, it's so that stuff has just always been a big part of how I think. And then the writers that I read always kind of, I mean, a lot of my favorite writers were either science fiction writers or writers who were like working in a kind of adjacent space, like Thomas Pynchon or like George Saunders, where there are kind of sci-fi elements in, you know, in a kind of literary fiction mode. And so it just always felt really natural to me as the answer. But I think that for me, it allows me to write about like certain states or ways of feeling. Like it's like sometimes the best way to write about feeling really anxious or scared or something is to write about things that couldn't possibly happen in real life, just the way things feel, to kind of ramp up the feeling on the page. I suppose that's it. It lets me write about ways that I feel exactly without having to be too literal about it.
When does your new book come out?
June 11th. It's a book of stories. It's called Beautiful Days, and it's coming out with Doubleday.
When did this project start and when did this end? So obviously June 11th is a massive day for you, but when did this process start?
The earliest story, there's 10 stories in the collection, and the earliest one was, you know, I started when I was teaching at Browning. It was like in that period that we talked about. So it's all the stuff, it's all those stories that I was working on, you know, in that time period that we were discussing. So I think that earliest one I started in 2015 or something. So I think that I like worked on this book in earnest for like 8 or 9 years, depending on it's I don't know where you'd put this. There might be different places you could put the exact start and the exact finish, but yeah, it was years. It was a lot harder than I ever imagined it was going to be when I started.
That's awesome. Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is a loaded question. What does success look like for you as a writer?
That's a great question. As far as like publishing stuff is concerned, I think I had to, like, there was a little bit of like a learning curve about like, oh, okay, like this stuff is going to be out in the world and people are going to read it. And it's might sound funny, but it was kind of hard for me to actually imagine that when I was first working on it. So that's always like kind of like a little bit of a funny thing that like I think I'm learning slowly to get used to. And then I think too, it's like I feel busier this year, as I was just saying. And I think I look back now on like that time when I was at NYU and then the last couple of years, and I think back to all that space I had to do work and my writing work, I mean. And so I start to think a little bit about how I might carve some more of that out for myself moving forward. So I don't know. There's some practical considerations like that, I guess. But it's very exciting too. It's been a great few years. I feel really lucky.
Where do you hope to be from a writing standpoint in your career in 10 years? Is it more short stories like in The New Yorker? Is it more books? Have you not thought about that far? Because that feels like a long way away.
No, yeah, I think it'd be great if I had another book out 10 years from now. If I had two more books out 10 years from now, that'd be amazing. If I can find a way to keep doing this, because I don't take that at all for granted, you know, if I could find a way to keep doing this, do some teaching at the graduate level, that's something that I've never done that I would be very interested in doing. I think like a life that is kind of balanced between writing and teaching and family is what I would hope to just kind of, that'd be great if I could make that happen.
As a member of the class of 2002 and being 22 years removed from Wilmington Friends School, I was wondering what advice you might give to a member of this year's senior class.
Yeah, 22 years. Wow. It's been a long 22 years, I think, since 2002. I mean, it's like a lot has happened in the world. And, I'm going to turn 40 this year, which, you know, I think in a lot of ways, like in the world today, 40 doesn't really feel all that old to me. Like I still feel fairly young. But those 22 years also feel like really long and really consequential. And I have seen really big changes happen in the world. And I guess also in my life too, that I wouldn't have thought possible 22 years ago. Like some of them are good changes, some of them aren't, but the world is really different now than it was when I graduated. So I guess things don't stay the same is my sense. And I had to see that in action to understand it or believe it. I don't think I maybe understood how much the world was capable of changing when I was 18. So I guess I'd say that there's probably more possibility than you think for yourself or for the world more broadly, that things aren't going to stay the way they are. And that can be really scary, but that there's also a lot of opportunity inherent there as well. And so I just feel like, I don't know, there's no need to be modest about your ambitions or your hopes. You know, if there's something that you want to do or something that you want to see happen in the world, to just move toward it, you know, one little tiny step at a time, and you know you can be a part of how things change. That's what I would say.
And now this becomes advice corner with Zach, but for folks that are like interested in potentially getting into writing as like a career, what's one thing you might tell them? It feels like very isolating, like by yourself work. So that can be both great for some people, but also challenging. So yeah, just what's one piece of advice you might give to someone looking to enter your world?
I like that solitude part of it. I really like that. And so I guess I think probably I would hazard to guess that somebody looking to get into it would have that inclination themselves. But of course, there's other more social ways of writing too, like to be in a writer's room on a television show or something. And that's something that I don't know anything about. But But no, it is true that I would kind of bet that somebody that has a sense that they like it, like sort of already likes to be on their own. And then, I guess I would say that what I felt like I learned is that the steps toward publishing fiction, like, are actually just very, very concrete steps you can take. Like, it's not all that kind of abstract or mysterious, really. It's like you just start working on something, if you just keep working on something, and whatever time you have, or to like prioritize your time that way, like if you just keep writing until you have enough to apply to an MFA program, which I think is something that I was maybe a little bit cynical about from the outset. But then, having gone through an MFA program, it was like I really did learn so incredibly much. I didn't feel that, I don't know, sometimes there can be a sense that MFA programs are a place where writing gets flattened, or writers kind of start to write more like one another or something. I didn't really feel that way about it. I thought it was great. I got a great education. There are a lot of MFA programs that fully fund their students, like similar to PhD programs. So you can, it's very common for people to, keep working on their writing and apply several years in a row until they get a seat at a program that has funding. So you can do that. And then at the tail end of the program, you've got a lot of work, and you can use that work to reach out to agents. It's like there's not a lot of mystery actually about how that works. It's like people are have their contact information is public, and you can look it up, and you can send queries to agents, and then from there agents try to place your work. And so there's a lot of things that need to happen, but it's actually a very sort of like, it's not an invisible process, is one thing that I learned about it.
One final question for you, and another kind of impossible one here, but asking you to reflect on your time here at Friends as a lifer, is there one specific or particular, I should say, memorable moment that really stands out that sort of demonstrates, highlights your time here as a student? Knowing that, again, you have a lot of history here and that this is a tough one.
No, I really treasured I just loved playing in the jazz band at Wilmington Friends School. I played drums in the jazz band, and I took drum lessons through the school, and I really, really remember vividly my like jazz band performances. I think I felt like really exhilarated by getting to perform in front of people. And I especially, I think, because I had kind of grown up, like the way that the school was organized, being that like starting in sixth grade, you would sometimes go to assemblies that included the upper school. Like I remember like watching the musicians in the jazz band, like the people who were sophomores, juniors, and seniors when I was a sixth grader. And like they just seemed like so, it just seemed so incredible to me. And they were so talented. And then so to kind of like slowly come up and get to join that program, that was really great. There was one year in particular, one concert in particular, where we had kind of like a sort of a ragtag group of musicians, and we planned the program, like we designed the program for our concert ourselves. And so we just played all kinds of things, like very atypical jazz band stuff. Like we played like Moby Dick by Led Zeppelin is what I remember playing, with like a big drum solo in it. And that was really, really fun. That's a memory that I really treasure.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk a little about you, your time here at Friends, and all the work that you're doing. And congratulations again on the book.
Oh, thanks very much. It was great to talk to you. I appreciate you having me.